and now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Happy Friday. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always, and I mean always, been in you. Very excited to be here with you today and every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, and each and every week. If you've been following along, these broadcasts, as you know, focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, and it's all placed within the context of our relationships that we have with ourselves and who is looking back at us when we look at ourselves in the mirror, our relationship with others and God or the divine. And here's the reason why I place this integration clearly in the context of relationships, because we are social creatures. That's a given. Okay. And when we think about it, we often receive our deepest physical, sometimes emotional, sometimes psychological, and even sometimes spiritual wounds, all within the context of relationships with one another. And however, we can also discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And this is indeed the irony. And these relationships just might be within our own families and coworkers and friends, because whenever we transform, we also transform others by our presence. We transform others by our grace and our understanding. But first, forgiveness and kindness and compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because when we are compassionate with ourselves, then we can be more compassionate with others. And it goes to say that when we are forgiving with ourselves, then we can be more forgiving with others. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves for every breath that we take, we then discover how this opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with those around us. So all in all, transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website and leave me your comments. The website is www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity, all one word. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And these broadcasts are now podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows, whether you're driving in the car or waiting around, or just simply you're a fan of the show and just want to pull it up and see what other exciting things we've been talking about. So also, if you would like to be part of today's show, I invite you to call in. It's toll-free line, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And when you call in, I want you to give me your insights and comments and thoughts on today's subject, the war against the weak and wounded. Or, let's put it another way, why does humanity typically shoot its wounded? Okay. And for those of you new to the program, I'd just like to say that I am a huge believer that all of us come into this world already equipped and graced with everything we need for this life. We come into this world with our giftedness. We come into the world with our skills and our talents and our strengths and character traits, personality, and so forth. And yet, as we go along in life, and maybe due to some unpleasant circumstances or experiences, we may feel like we need to hide that giftedness, or perhaps we don't want to show our strengths and our skills to others because perhaps those things were exposed or exploited in some way. Or, you know, perhaps that we push our talents way down so that others cannot see it. Or even so, you know, perhaps we were told when we were young that we would never amount to anything. Or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. And that's just untrue. Totally untrue. But at any rate, what happens then is that we don't realize our giftedness. We don't realize that there is so much more to us than even what we have discovered so far. And we just don't really appreciate just how much there is to us. This vast self, if you were. Okay, so unfortunately, when we don't realize our giftedness, we tend to bring everything into relationships from a place of woundedness or a place of being the victim, victimhood or victimization, instead of a place of healing and wholeness and embracing our hechaitas or uniqueness, as it's called. So, how is everybody doing today? I said, welcome to Friday. Here we are. You know, we have what, 9 days, and then we're going to be 10 days, and then we're going to be in March. And just unbelievable how fast the year is going. And we here in the Mid-Atlantic states on the East Coast over the past few days have experienced quite a bit of snow. And in addition to the snow, we also have been getting ice and freezing temperatures. And I'm looking out my window right now. And it is flurrying again. So we're not out of the woods yet. Certainly the groundhog is living up to his little prediction that we have 6 more weeks of winter. So anyway, but wherever you are, I hope that you are safe. I hope that you are well. I hope that you are warm. And I hope, first and foremost, that you are filled with peace today. Well, for today's show, I have to begin by saying that the quote of the day, shall I say, the quote of the day comes from George Santayana, and I'm quoting from his book, The Life of Reason. And I don't know if you've ever heard of it or you're familiar with it, but he wrote this way back in 1905, you know, just a little after the turn of the century. And it's a very popular saying, okay, very popular quote, and he writes, "If we do not learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it. If we do not learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it." Now, later on, around 1948 or so, in a speech to the House of Commons, Winston Churchill paraphrased Santayana when he was overheard saying that those who fail to learn from history are condemned to repeat it. So, like I said, he paraphrased it, but he's saying the exact same thing. We have to pay attention to the lessons that have gone on before us. Otherwise, we're just going to keep passing it on and passing it on and passing it on. Now, I have to say that if there is ever a lesson that humanity has failed to learn over and over and over and over again, it's that society's contempt for people who are considered unlovable or untouchable or unreachable. This has to be one of the most unrelenting patterns of behavior by which society's contempt for people who just, you know, according to whatever definition society wants to throw out there, for people who just do not fit a certain mold or they don't fit a certain expectation or an ideal. I mean, what is ideal after all? You know, what is normal after all? It's based on a standard, but again, who sets these standards? And what is this measuring stick? Or, you know, what is this expectation that everybody, if you're going to have value and worth and dignity in this world, well, then you have to measure up. And that is just a toxic, toxic lesson. And yet, how many people try to squeeze themselves into what they would call a perfected mold of what society says, well, this is the way you should do it, and this is the way you should be, and this is how you should look, and this is what you need to do to be successful in life, as if there's only one way to be successful. Okay. And, you know, we could take this understanding, or I should, it's not really an understanding. Let me back up on that one. We can take this misguided, lesson that's being perpetuated down through the centuries. We can take this one step further, and we can certainly ask that, why are people who are considered weak and wounded, why are they often made to feel unlovable, untouchable, and unreachable? Okay, it's just another way of looking at this question, but it gets at the heart of it. Okay, it just society's contempt for people who do not fit a certain mold, expectation, or ideal. Okay, well, years ago, I read a book entitled The War Against the Weak, W-E-A-K. And it was written by Edwin Black, and kind of blocking on the year that it was, I have it right in front of me here, blocking on the year that it came out. I am looking at, I believe it's the early 2000s, I want to say, and yep, 2003 is when it first came out. So anyway, The War Against the Weak, written by Edwin Black. And what Edwin Black does is he takes a closer look at America's eugenics history and its campaign to create this so-called master race. And whenever, you know, we hear that phrase, you know, the master race, we automatically want to think of the Nazis. Okay, but interestingly enough, this idea or this teaching or this whatever definition from society really had its origins more in America. Okay? And that's what this book is about, The War Against the Weak by Edmund Black. And it's a very forthtelling book, and it's not the kind of book that you want to read before going to bed, because you're either not going to be able to fall asleep or you're going to have nightmares. Okay, so, you know, read it at your leisure, but allow plenty of time for you to process it, because it is quite unnerving. But I would also like to expand this notion of, you know, war against the weak a little bit further to often, you know, to also include how often we treat people who experience being wounded in one form or another. Okay. And so that's why I titled this broadcast, you know, The War Against the Weak and the Wounded. And why does society seem like, you know, they want to, you know, have the right to shoot their wounded? And this is an understanding where, you know, the what society would promote sometimes if a horse came up lame, or a horse had a broken leg, or a horse was sick and in pain, we would often just, you know, shoot the horse, okay, kind of take it out of its misery. But we can't really apply that to humanity, you know, because it just seems like whatever this understanding that comes from society, they use this, you know, well, we'll just shoot our wounded because they happen to be such a drag on society, or it costs too much to be able to deal with this, let's say, another way, or maybe the proper way. Okay. Well, I wanted to share with you some of my own research in this area. Like I said, I've been, you know, doing this for a while, and I'm just thoroughly still amazed of just what I run across and just how humanity has treated humanity down through the centuries. And as I said, it's just, if we don't learn from the past, if we don't change the past, we're doomed to just keep on repeating it. All right. So, just let's toss out a question here. So how do we learn from history? And really, where does it begin? You know, how far back do we have to go? Well, this whole notion of, you know, humanity or society, I should say, feels like it can shoot its wounded, or, you know, treat, you know, people just poorly, or have this template of, you know, people are, you know, whom we consider unlovable, unreachable, and therefore untouchable. You know, we'll just, you know, we'll take it from there. And, you know, society just perpetuates this over and over again. Well, I don't want to go back to the beginning of time because, well, we only have an hour, but I do want to take us back to how in the world did this attitude, this perspective, this understanding get into American society? Okay, because it did shape and does shape American history for the longest time, and we can even point to accounts even today. Well, let's go back to the 1800s, okay? And this is, you know, where the rise of eugenics all started, or the good genes. And with the invention of better microscopes, it allowed scientists to discover just the basic facts of cell division and sexual reproduction, and just a better understanding of diseases and so forth, viruses and that. And research started to then shift to a genetic understanding of what really happens in the transmission of what we would call, you know, hereditary traits from parents to children, or great-grandparents, the grandparents, the parents, the children, and so forth, okay? And Gregor Mendel, he lived in the early to late 1800s. He was a European monk whose research with plants basically outlined these principles of heredity, which then he later applied to, you know, include animals and people. Okay. And so, Mendel, he studied the separation of inheritable traits, okay, in pea plants. Okay. And these inheritable traits, what he meant by that was just the flower color, okay, of the pea plants. Now, I granted he lived back in a day and an age in which he didn't have PlayStation, he didn't have Nintendo, he didn't have Xbox, he didn't have the internet, he didn't have movies, but his thing was pea plants, okay? And he took meticulous notes. I mean, he was just either OCD or something, but he just took meticulous notes. And that was his thing. You know, maybe he was in charge of the vegetable garden, and maybe his fellow monks just got sick of eating, you know, so many peas, but that was his thing. So anyway, he just studied this to separate the separation of inheritable traits, or the color of the flower, in pea plants. And he observed that the flowers of each pea plant were either purple or white. And so he started to take this one step further through this selective technique of crossbreeding common pea plants over many generations. Mendel discovered that certain traits show up in offspring without blending any of the parent characteristics. In other words, with each succeeding pea plant generation, sometimes the flower color would be purple, sometimes the flower color would be white, and out of that, when the peas themselves, he was able to predict whether or not, once he started to shell them, if the peas would be all green, or if they would be yellow, or if they would be a combination of green and yellow, and how often those patterns started to repeat. Okay. And like I said, he concluded, you know, or in his conclusions, I should say, he really helped pave the way for society to understand the nature of human genetic inheritances, such as our chromosomes or our traits and diseases. Okay. And this was groundbreaking. Okay. This was very good work that he had done. But one such individual who studied Mendel's work was Sir Francis Galton. Now, he was a cousin to Charles Darwin, okay, and maybe that name rings a bell. But during Galton's time, and he also lived in the mid-1800s, there were two dominant teachings that were emerging about the human race, okay? And one was that as hardier races evolved over time, they would perfect society into this survival of the fittest. And that's where Charles Darwin comes in. Okay. He also used that language as well. And, further on this, one teaching, he said that, or Galton said that the inferior races would progressively become more impoverished or less educated and eventually die off. And needless to say, many people viewed mixing of races as diluting superior races. And so there was all kinds of prejudices flying around about people marrying outside their ethnicity or their race. Okay. And the other popular belief among the, shall we say, the elite class of England was that most of society's problems, or what was considered problems, such as poverty or crime or illiteracy of their industrialized revolution, stemmed from certain groups of people passing on their so-called inferior genes and then producing social misfits, as they were called back then. And I have to apologize because the language is very archaic. But these were the notes, and this is the research that I found. Now, to test his theory, Galton studied the characteristics of, shall we say, upper-class people in England. You know, they were well-educated, and they possessed strong dispositions, they were rich, they were well-spoken, whatever, all the admirable traits needed for a society to stand head and shoulders over other nations. But it wasn't until, you know, he wrote a book of inquiries into human faculty and its development, and this was in the late 1800s, that Galton coined the term eugenics, which explained his, you know, in his theory that there was much more to hereditary than merely transmitting physical traits, you know, like hair color, eye color, whether or not you have short legs or long legs, whatever it is. But he also included that with hereditary, it also included passing on mental and emotional qualities as well. So again, Galton takes this one step further, and he went so far as to say that he could improve the quality of certain, again, this is his language, inferior human populations by discouraging reproduction of persons having genetic defects or inherited undesirable traits. Okay. And Galton promoted that belief that, you know, humanity could help direct its future by selectively breeding individuals who have these so-called desired traits. And as a result, science then became the means to be able to promote class hatred and bigotry, or as Edwin Black described it, a eugenic crusade. Well, it didn't take long for Galton's belief to catch on in America, who was struggling with its own socioeconomic issues in the dawn of its own industrial revolution. And a zoologist named Charles Davenport, picked up on Galton's work. He was intrigued by it, and he saw ethnic groups as biologically different. The heredity and genetics, and just looking at things from a biological standpoint, that, you know, especially there were differences in their character, nature, and quality. And his work came out in like the mid-1930s. But like Galton, Davenport also became obsessed with race mixing, as he would put it, and often criticized America for being the melting pot, which he saw as a result of what he coined stubborn, isolated breeding. And Davenport was convinced that the American government, or I should say he convinced the American government, to eliminate people that he coined as, you know, inadequate and unfit. Okay? You see where this is going? Okay? And, you know, at that point, it was the emphasis was to search throughout the nation to methodically identify exactly which races were qualified, according to that messed up definition, which races were qualified to continue and which ones were not. And so Davenport, he goes off in search of, you know, he did his own little research, and, he sought eugenic records in, and again, this is very archaic language here, in about 42 institutions for the feeble-minded, 115 schools for homes for the deaf and blind, 350 hospitals for the insane, 1,200 refugee or refuge homes, 1,300 prisons, 1,500 hospitals, and about 2,500 almshouses or almshouses. Okay. And within this report, Davenport, he had all the necessary data at his fingertips to be able to justify his scientific theories on these so-called inferior races. And this is the part that I just find extremely, just unbelievable, as if this isn't already all unbelievable. Davenport classified feeble-mindedness, and he linked it with people who suffered from epilepsy, you know, and he also linked in people with severe mental health issues, and people who cannot care for themselves, or whether or not they were shy or they stuttered or poor command of the English language, and even nonverbal, you know, regardless of their talent and intellect. And epilepsy seemed to be, for people with epilepsy, it seemed to be targeted as a mental weakness, as it was believed that epilepsy was in the genes, and therefore this mental weakness was passed on from one generation to another generation to another generation. And growing up, I always remember my mother telling me stories that when she was a little girl, how often she would be scolded by teachers and mistreated by friends for having epilepsy. And she struggled with this all her life as she got older and so forth. And on occasion, she would say that she'd have a seizure in class, which often then led her to being shunned by friends or ridiculed by neighbors, and or causing her to carry a baggage of shame, as she put it sometimes, which was not hers to carry. And she carried this for many, many years. So again, I mean, we see even, you know, how the most vulnerable in society, that is those who are weak and vulnerable and susceptible to diseases and illnesses, how these people were taken advantage by those in power, or those who defined illness and, you know, made these roles and made these rules. Okay. So as a result, the result of Davenport's work, you know, once the people who were of this so-called lower genetic quality, and they were found in these institutions and houses of charity and so forth, once he was able to identify them, it didn't take long for those in charge of the medical community to insist on forced sterilization laws. And you go back through the history of America, and you'd be surprised just where these laws landed in the United States. Okay, every state, it seemed like the majority of them, had some form of sterilization laws. And again, it was looked at as, well, these laws not only prevented the so-called feeble-minded from reproducing more of their kind, but also it was intended to spare society from bearing the burden of their behavior or cognitive limitations. And so this forced sterilization also extended to people who were being released from prison in order that they would not be able to reproduce more of their kind. And nonetheless, state legislation, as I said, began to enact their own forced sterilization laws on people who were considered feeble-minded. Now, folks out there in internet radio land, you ain't heard nothing yet. Okay? Because in 1905, where I live, Pennsylvania's legislature passed the Act for Prevention of Idiocy, which empowered surgeons, you know, this was lawful for surgeons back then, to perform operations for the prevention of procreation. In other words, you know, they were allowed to sterilize people. And it wasn't just Pennsylvania. You know, after a while, it was Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Oregon, Washington, California, Nevada, Iowa, New Jersey, and New York followed suit. And interestingly enough, it was the state of Virginia that seemed to be the one place where forced sterilization really took its toll on the people following World War I. And this is something that Edwin Black brings out in his book. He says Virginia was considered the collecting place for people who were poor and uneducated and diagnosed with epilepsy and feeble-mindedness and others who were considered morally unfit by the state. Okay, and then with more and more studies being done on Virginia, you know, they had this Eugenical Sterilization Act of 1924, which immediately targeted feeble-minded women of childbearing age from about 12 years old to 45 years old. Okay, and these women were being targeted. And Virginia's Eugenical Sterilization Act of 1924 became the model for the United States. You know, as sterilization rates increased and the categories of people that qualified or so-called qualified for sterilization were broadly expanded to include now criminals or prostitutes and the homeless. And it's estimated that somewhere between 7,200 and 8,300 people were sterilized in Virginia, forced sterilization from 1927 to 1979. And yes, you heard right, 1927 to 1979. And there's just one example after another, after another, after another. Okay. Well, let's pause for a moment and let's all take a deep breath. Okay, because I really want to hear your heart on this subject. So if you want to call in, you know, the number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in about 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, just before we get back into the show again, a word about next week's show. It'll be Friday, February 26th, 2021, The Power of One Voice. The Power of One Voice. And, you know, this is often people downplay the power of their voice. You know, either thinking that their voice isn't strong enough, or what they have to say, it doesn't need to be heard, or again, it's just whatever message people believe. But there is power in the voice, because that's where the energy is. Okay? The power of one voice. So I invite you to tune in next Friday, February 26th. Well, early in the show, we were talking about the quote from George Santayana from his book. It was The Life of Reason back in 1905. And this is where the phrase, if we do not learn from history, we are doomed to repeat it. That's where that shows up. Okay. And as I said at the beginning of the broadcast, that if there ever is a lesson that humanity has failed to learn over and over and over again, just been unable to correct this, it's that society's contempt for people who are considered unlovable, untouchable, and unreachable. Okay, and we started to take a look at some of the forced sterilization laws that were being passed here in America. And, the forced sterilization continued to be funded by the American government, right? Funded by the American government, and it was quickly becoming part of the American landscape. Okay, and just here's a couple more examples. The first bill that it was proposed for sterilization for undesirables occurred in 1849. Okay, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, Gordon Lysacomb, a famed Texas biologist, and he was also a doctor. He proposed a bill mandating eugenic sterilization of the mentally handicapped and others whose genes he deems undesirable. Okay, however, that bill was never brought to a vote. Another one was the Indian Health Services from 1973, to 1976. And it was a study by the U.S. General Accounting Office that found 4 out of 12 Indian Health Service regions sterilized 3,406 American Indian women without their permission between 1973 and 1976. This happened in the 70s. Okay. And the General Accounting Office found that 36 women under the age of 21 had been forcibly sterilized during this period, despite a court-ordered moratorium on sterilizations of women younger than 21. And interestingly enough, the Indian Health Service had singled out full-blooded American Indian women for sterilization procedures. And in total, it was estimated that as many as 25 to 50% of Native American women were sterilized. Okay, let me give you just one more example here. The sterilization of Puerto Rican women back in 1965 reached about 30% of the population of women in Puerto Rico. Now, it was predominantly a Catholic society, and birth control was illegal till about 1930. And sterilization practices left about 30% of the women unable to have children by 1965. And the earliest governor of Puerto Rico is cited as saying that there were too many unskilled laborers and just not enough jobs for everybody in the island or on the island. So again, you take this understanding of eugenics and forced sterilization, and if you're looking at nothing but numbers and you're ignoring the value and dignity and worth of everyone, you're going to justify, let's say, thinning the crowd in order to, create many, many jobs. Okay. Now, this long sterilization campaign resulted in this practice, that eventually became birth control of choice for the Puerto Rican women. And instead of providing them the access to alternative forms of safe and legal and reversible contraception, U.S. policy promoted the use of permanent sterilization. Okay, and women women in general, the misinformation became a common tool, and women were often told that their status, namely related to their immigration, housing, government benefits, or parenting, would be negatively impacted if they do not consent to this sterilization procedure. And yet many of these women were told that these procedures were, they're just temporary or they are reversible. Okay. And, of course they weren't. They were permanent. Right. So, just unbelievable. And there's many, many more examples. I'm just, you know, this is just tip of the iceberg stuff. But it's just interesting when you go back into American history and you just realize what was going on. And many of these practices became law, became the norm. And as I said at the beginning of the show, society just kept on perpetuating this. I don't even have words for it at times. I just, you know, just a disregard for human life. Just a disregard for, like, well, if, you know, we need to tidy things up, so to speak, we can just eliminate a few people here and there. You know, but this isn't like taking out the trash when your house gets dirty. You know, this is something different. Okay? So what is the point? You know, what is the point of all this? What lesson does society need to learn? Well, it's this. You know, this kind of intergenerational trauma has the potential to disconnect us from fully realizing who we are as souls. And the reason for this is because, you know, trauma places this distorted template over our perceptions and our self-perceptions. Now, in other words, trauma says to us, you know, this is all there is. This is all that it is to you. This is as good as it gets. Don't expect anything better. And which is all lies and distortions that come from, let's say, other wounded people who have yet to heal and embrace themselves and see themselves as a soul with value, dignity, and worth. However, once we embrace ourselves as a soul, and that it's not just a mental concept, once we fully realize that there is so much more to us than even what we realize today, we just may be astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma and transform our wounded energy, but it also empowers others to do the same. Okay, so still, as history teaches us, many have feared the resiliency and power of the soul and therefore have tried to silence humanity or those who speak out, tried to silence its cry, the cry of the soul, you know, through killings or murders or genocide or starvations or forced assimilations or humiliation, degradations, looking at people as savages, primitive, or backward, unworthy, unlovable, and therefore disposable, as those in control see fit. And what's heartbreaking to me is that the further I dug into just what's going on with these atrocities, how many times these atrocities have been committed in the name of God. Committed by people who should be able to see themselves as a soul. In fact, even when killing was done in the name of advancing the kingdom of God, the only thing that's truly advancing is the distorted view from those who will do anything to hang on to their power. You know, people who want to stay in control. People who think, well, I am better than you because, you know, just look at all outward appearances and, you know, I'm in a much better place and shape than the average person and therefore I get to make the rules. Well, I've said this before. Hopefully you remember me saying this, but, you know, all the isms that are out there, racism, you know, genderism, ageism, you know, whatever ism we have, that's all based on the externals. But when we start to see each other as a soul and, you know, just truly as souls, all the isms disappear. The isms can't follow because, well, we're not looking at the externals anymore. We're not looking at just pure physical aspects or traits of people, but we're seeing people for who they truly are. And trauma is not the only thing that has been passed down through the generations, but it is also the very systems that fuel prejudices or feelings of contempt and a distorted view of life that have been galvanized or reinforced that often leaves generations after generations after generations in what I would call a voiceless disparity. You know, their voice has been taken away. They feel like they cannot speak up. They are not empowered to do so. Okay? But a huge part of healing intergenerational trauma and moving people toward a healthy sense of who they are involves not only understanding these historical distortions, but also grieving that which has been taken from them. Okay. And one of my favorite examples is just how do I explain this process in my own counseling therapy to clients is very similar to the movie The Wizard of Oz. And well, I think it always comes around sometime in the spring, so look for it. It should be coming up in March and April. But very, very popular movie. I mean, everybody I talk to has seen it and love it. And the storyline involves very subtle yet powerful lessons, because most people can typically relate to this movie on some personal level. And perhaps one reason why this movie is such a beloved classic is that there's actually two stories going on at the same time. You know, on one hand, we are taking on a journey with all the companions of Dorothy, right? The Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion, the Tin Man, and let's throw in Toto too, okay? And they all believe that they, you know, are in search of something that they are convinced is lacking in themselves. And so their adventures take them to seek the wizard. Okay? You know, we know the story, right? The Tin Man needed a heart. The Scarecrow needed a brain. The Cowardly Lion needed courage. And of course, Dorothy just wanted to go home. Okay? Yet, on the other hand, this trip is really about an inward journey that they make in order to discover who they are. And this is actually the second story that's going on. You know, it's very subtle, but it's there. And as they set out, their journey is filled with dangerous encounters and harrowing escapes from the Wicked Witch of the West and her minions. And I have to say that as a young boy, those flying monkeys really creeped me out. I had nightmares for the longest time because, well, they weren't exactly pretty, I'll put them to you that way. But they just creeped me out as a boy, okay? So, you know, they're dodging, you know, these monkeys and the Wicked Witch of the West and all that. But yet after the witch is defeated, okay, and the wizard, they commanded them, go kill the Wicked Witch of the West. And, you know, and all is well, the four companions go back to the wizard to receive their rewards. And it was nothing like they expected. In fact, it was this, you know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, but then the jig was up and whoa, that's it. You know, the secret was out. And the wizard then takes them back in time and, you know, just where have you been on your journey? And explains that, you know, through their ordeal, they each displayed what they lacked. The Tin Man displayed a tremendous heart of devotion and loyalty. The Scarecrow turned out to be the brains of the outfit. And go figure, okay? And the Cowardly Lion showed remarkable courage in the face of overwhelming odds. And Dorothy, as we all know, she had the ability to go home anytime she wanted. Just click your heels three times and there's no place like home. And boom, there she was. And she finally realized that there was no other place more magical than her own home and those who loved her. And so, throughout the story of The Wizard of Oz, we have this classic example of people who are in search of things that they believe they lack, but later come to realize they had these characteristics all along. Kind of sounds like reclaiming authenticity. Exactly. Okay. And I have yet to meet anyone who begins a journey of self-discovery that sooner or later has to work through some personal and or family traumatic experiences, as well as re-examine the stories that have been handed down to them by those also needing to come to terms with their own trauma and come to terms with who they really are. And in a sense, family perspectives and interpretations of these traumatic events seem to go hand in hand. In fact, sometimes trauma becomes a way in which individuals and families and generations have defined themselves, which then perpetuates this cycle of intergenerational trauma. Okay? So, for example, if grandparents and parents and other caregivers do not have a healthy sense of themselves, or they too are struggling with intergenerational traumatic experiences, then they will unconsciously pass their issues on to younger generations, and they will pass on to them their fears and anxieties and insecurities and their abandonment issues, and that's just to name a few. Okay, but there is also a beauty that I find in counseling therapy that's not just about alleviating mental health symptoms in clients who are troubled, but it also involves helping them discover who they are and the gifts and character strengths that they already possess. In other words, helping people remove their emotional, behavioral, and/or spiritual obstructions so that they may embrace themselves authentically. Okay? And this was part of the reason why I wrote the book, Reclaiming Authenticity, back in 2014. I state that everybody has been given what they need when they come into this world. Their power, their energy, their gifts and talents, resiliency, personality, and everything. However, it's through the various experiences that we often are misled to believe that in order to survive or thrive in this world, we must first deny who we are. And we end up giving away our power, and we settle for living by another's inauthentic definitions and rules. And as a result, we end up searching for our true selves in all the wrong places, instead of looking within our own soul. Because interesting, when people fully embrace the fact that they are a soul and are indeed very, very precious in the eyes of God, the compassionate, nurturing side of humanity emerges in a very powerful way. Issues of prejudice, sexism, egocentrism, racism all go out the window. They just simply cannot dwell in what I would call the higher consciousness of the soul. Okay? Well, helping generations heal from traumatic issues in which they have learned mistrust or internalized skewed perceptions, which affected then their attachments and relationships and cognitive development and so forth. And when generations of a family are able to come together and address these issues, they quickly realize that healing such wounds is not a matter of placing blame, but understanding the impact of what has been handed down through these generations. Now, yes, there is a level of accountability and restorative justice that also needs to be addressed for, you know, crimes against humanity and so forth. But more importantly, perhaps we should acknowledge the woundedness that has also been passed on from many generations before. And, you know, for example, if a family member on back through the generations was struggling with an addiction, chances are that there is a family system in place that reinforced that wound. And because it was never dealt with, let's just say properly, it gets handed down, and it just gets handed down and handed down and handed down. Well, going back through the generations then, family members might become aware of how many others had, let's say, addictions issues. And suicide is also another family dynamic that comes down through the generations. And families, you know, today's families are certainly wise to investigate how certain emotional, psychological, or sociological factors set the stage for such perceptions and behaviors to unfold. Even if suicide attempts have not occurred in let's say, the present generation, feelings of hopelessness and despair may also have infiltrated the family's perceptions of powerlessness. Well, as we are drawing nigh to the end of the show, I want to share with you an ancient tradition, which I have shared before because it's one of my favorites. And it really displays the power of seeing a person for who they are, looking at a person and seeing the soul. Okay. And the ancient tradition I'm talking about is among indigenous tribes, which involve a powerful blessing from the grandmothers whenever a baby is born. Now, before the newborn is returned to the mother, the grandmothers of the village would take turns holding the child. And they would take their time, and they'd look deep into the child's eyes. And with a very, very loving tone, the grandmothers speak words of affirmation and tell the child how much he or she is loved by this community, loved by God, and is gifted with many good and precious gifts as a beautiful soul. And this grandmother's tradition begins this internalization process of love and security and trust in the infant, and truly reinforces the idea that indeed it takes a village to raise a child. Well, for the most part, healing is a matter of unlearning these generational lessons that have affected what family members believe about themselves, as well as how these perceptions have affected their own behaviors towards one another. And even if one's parents and grandparents are deceased, healing can still be achieved. You can still find healing by understanding the dynamics of trauma that has been handed down in the family, as well as appreciating the resiliency and other positive character strengths that family members possess. Emotional and psychological wounds are not the only thing that we may have inherited. Our character strengths, gifts, and skills, and so forth, and how we were nurtured has been handed down. So, I invite you to discover for yourself the very best of you. And don't settle for another's underdeveloped sense of who he or she thinks you should be for them. You have value. You have dignity. You have worth. And the very best in you is just waiting to come out. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Until we talk again next Friday, everybody, please be safe out there, stay out of trouble, and may God bless you.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.